afternoon, you're very welcome to Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, from Dublin to Berlin and further afield, the Anglo tapes have been met with shock and anger. But what will be the lasting impact of their release? The banks are told by the central bank to deal with those in debt using whatever means at their disposal, but will it help or hinder efforts to deal with growing mortgage arrears? And we'll get the latest on the standoff today between turf cutters and the Gardaí in the west of Ireland. But first, the news with John Finnerty.
Good afternoon. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has said the nation continues to pray for Nelson Mandela as the 94-year-old remains in a critical condition in hospital. Mr. Zuma made his comments during a joint news conference with the visiting US President Barack Obama after the two leaders met in Pretoria. Mr. Obama plans to meet relatives of Mr. Mandela privately, but doesn't intend to visit him in hospital. He told the news conference that Nelson Mandela, who's known as Madiba, had inspired people throughout the world.
The struggle here against apartheid, for freedom, Madiba's moral courage, this country's historic transition to a free and democratic nation, has been a personal inspiration to me. It has been an inspiration to the world, and it continues to be.
Iran's president-elect Hassan Rouhani has said he remains committed to his campaign promises of moderation and constructive interaction with the outside world. The reformist-backed cleric, who defeated conservative and hardline rivals in the election, will succeed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in August. Mr. Rouhani told a conference in Tehran that he would appoint ministers from across the country's political spectrum. Around 100 people have gathered at Monivet Bog in County Galway, where turf is being cut in defiance of the EU Habitats Directive. Bog owners began moving machinery onto the bog last night, and turf cutting commenced at dawn. Gardaí are maintaining a presence at the scene and monitoring the situation. In County Roscommon, over 30 turf cutters have gathered on a bog at Kiltevin near Roscommon town. Gardaí went to the area this morning. Organisers expect up to 30,000 people to take part in the annual Dublin Pride Parade in the city centre this afternoon. Motorists are being advised of road closures. Aisling Kenny reports.
The Dublin Pride Parade is due to begin at the Garden of Remembrance on Parnell Square at 2 o'clock this afternoon. It'll travel down O'Connell Street and is due to finish at the Pride Village in Merrion Square. The rally will be addressed in Merrion Square by several organisations. The theme of this year's parade is Live, Love and Be Proud. Lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender groups are hoping that today's turnout will be in excess of the 25,000 people that attended last year's event. Motorists are being advised of road closures in the city centre this afternoon due to the parade.
In sport, the rugby test series between the British and Irish Lions and Australia is all square after the Wallabies won the second test in Melbourne by 16 points to 15. The game's turning point and only try came after 75 minutes when Australian centre Adam Ashley Cooper crashed over near the corner and Christian Lilifano added the conversion to complement the three penalties he'd kicked earlier. Lee Halpeny, who kicked five penalties for the Lions, fell short with a long-range effort in injury time. The series now goes down to the wire, with the final test being played in Sydney next week. And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Continental Tyres. Keeping your car firmly in contact with the road this weekend and every weekend.
Cloudy and misty in places with patchy drizzle, but sunny spells will develop more widely this afternoon and evening. Rather warm in sunshine, with temperatures rising to between 17 and 22 degrees. Clare.
John, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. We welcome your views on any of the topics we're about to cover over the course of the next hour. You can text us 51551, email saturday@rte.ie. The Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. I'm joined on the programme today by the Minister for Social Protection, Joan Burton. Fianna Fáil's Billy Kelleher is in our Cork studio. David Hall is with us from the Irish Mortgage Holders Organisation. Brian Lucy, Professor of Finance at Trinity, and Ian Keogh, Assistant Editor of the Sunday Business Post. There's nowhere else really to start today, apart from those Anglo tapes and the new claims in the Irish Independent that the government advisers Merrill Lynch told the previous government to shut down Anglo-Irish Bank. Let's have a listen to David Drum, the former Anglo CEO, talking to his then senior executive John Bowe about the Merrill Lynch take on Anglo's position in December 2008.
They Merrill Lynch are so badly against us, it's scary. The board asked me today, what did you do on them?
Really?
Yes, and I'm not sure, but I said somewhere along the line, you know, their analyst, everybody just jumped ugly at us.
Yeah.
And now they just seem to be disproportionately angry at us.
Everybody,
say Merrill's. And according to Alan Dukes today, the government ignored Merrill's advice and didn't shut us. You know, they wanted us nationalised, just take them off the field, they're a basket case. And ignored the advice and said, no, we want to see if we can get the banks through this.
Billy Keller, I'm going to come to you first because it's pretty bad news for Fianna Fáil, would you agree? Because the defence has always been that the government of the day got bad advice on Anglo, and that's directly contradicted in that clip.
Well, it's not, because that is in December 2008. That particular tape is, the guarantee was earlier in September of 2008. And if you look at the whole Merrill report, it does outline a number of options. They were called in to give advice to the government in view of the fact that there was an international credit crisis. Our banks were under huge pressure and stress. There was now more than liquidity. There was also an insolvency problem. But at the heart of that, prior to the actual guarantee itself in September, Merrill Lynch did outline a number of options. But this particular tape relates to December 2008, you know, a number of months after the actual guarantee itself. So I do think, you can just pick out one or two particular incidents from this particular thing. You have to look at the fact and the sequencing of it, you know, prior to the guarantee and right throughout the events after that as well.
OK, what about David Drum outlining in another clip today how he had plotted and planned to burn the bondholders at least 50% of their holdings, which would have saved an estimated $9 billion, and that didn't happen?
Yes, but you see, like, we're now taking David Drum as a star witness. I mean, only a couple of days ago, he was the most reviled figure in Ireland. Now we're taking his words verbatim in everything he says. I mean, if people want to get to the bottom of this, I mean, I think people should interview all the serious principal people that were involved, like the central bank governors, the regulators, the members of government that were present on the night, the bankers that were present on the night. And incidentally, what I find very, very bizarre in all of this discussion, there seems to be an obsession that Anglo were inside in government buildings on the night of the guarantee. The two banks that were inside there on the night were Bank of Ireland and AIB. And they were quite clear in their view that the game was up for the banking system in this country if a guarantee of some form was not put in place. And the governor of the central bank, the regulators and all those involved around giving advice to the government at the time took that decision. Now, people can say with the wisdom of hindsight that it was wrong. But I mean, we have to be fair and look at what was happening on the night on 2008 when the financial credit crisis was widespread across the world. We had banking collapses. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had been taken to a form of government protection. So clearly there was panic out there. And all I'm saying is, look, you know, we have members of government now, even the Taoiseach, you know, saying that there was an axis of collusion and all that flows from that. I mean, if people are really serious about getting to the bottom of that, if they read the Honan report, read the Nyberg report, they would know an awful lot of what actually happened, because there's all people want to do now, particularly in government circles, and I find this quite distasteful. I mean, oppositions, you know, can be loose with words, but Taoiseach and members of government cannot be loose with words, and they can't just go around throwing out collusions of axis of collusions and conspiracy theories. The facts so far are there in Nyberg, and if they want a further investigation, have an investigation that actually will find out everything.
Billy, you mentioned what Enda Kenny had to say, and I'm about to play you a clip of what he said earlier in the week in the Dáil. He's since gone on to say that there was a situation where there was a toxic nexus between the banking world and the world of government and senior personnel. But before we come to that statement, let's have a listen to what he said in the Dáil earlier in the week.
Now, what we need is to get at the truth here, because we have to remember that while it's easy to be shocked and absolutely angry about what's going on here, we should remember, Deputy Martin, who the victims are in this case. And the victims are the tens of thousands of families, ordinary people around this country, who became victims of the axis of collusion between Anglo-Irish Bank and Fianna Fáil and the bankers in general, to inflate the property business, to buy their houses at inflated mortgages and inflated prices, and find that when this crash happened, they have been left devoid of their business, devoid of their incomes, and mortgaged to the hilt for the next generation.
Deputy Martin,
I think your response confirms why it will be impossible to have a non-partisan independent inquiry conducted by the Oireachtas here. the use of the word collusion and the various other things you said all confirm how incapable you and those in your party will be of conducting any impartial inquiry. But that's not the point, even notwithstanding the fact that it would undoubtedly be partisan, as per your recent comments.
Now, Minister Joan Burton, your response to what Billy said before we heard that clip, and also what's going on there, that we have political point scoring, really, on the back of the Anglo tapes this week. Niall Collins, the Fianna Fáil Justice spokesperson, says that Enda Kenny's happy to allow the people who are on the tapes to escape without sanction if it allows him to create a series of political show trials. What's your response?
Well, I think that Niall Collins is being unbelievably politically partisan in his comments. Let's have a look at what people in the country want. What people in the country want, I think, is to hear the full story from everybody who is involved. And to be honest, whether Fianna Fáil like it or not, and at the moment they don't like it much, they actually were the government and they were the key decision makers who took whatever advice or whatever information they had. And it didn't arise, Claire, on the night of the guarantee. The banking system went down over a period of time because we had a system which was the heart of Fianna Fáil's political message of the time, of tax breaks to fund the property market, of developers then who got loans from Anglo. And those developers in turn, and I'm sure Billy wouldn't deny it, were the major funders in many instances of the Fianna Fáil party. So for Fianna Fáil to go into denial that somehow or other they had nothing to do with this, they were in government but they weren't connected to it, I would say that that is a high level of denial.
In fairness to Billy Keller, I don't think that's what he said, John. He did say that the politicians who were there on the night of the bank guarantee should answer questions. So I don't think he's saying that they shouldn't.
But it goes back to more than just the night of the bank guarantee. And if the country is to have a catharsis, there is, I think, an important point in the story being told. Now, if it is done, as is proposed by the Dáil Committee, I do feel strongly that there are ways of structuring the Dáil Committee. For instance, I think the Dáil Committee should be assisted by, for example, a senior lawyer, a senior accountant, preferably with forensic accounting experience and with experience of the banks. And I actually think Billy is right in saying there have been four reports up to now which tell us a lot, but which by and large are anonymous in relation to who did what and don't actually have very detailed timelines either. So what I think the people who would be the experts assisting and shaping the work of the committee in a responsible way...
Because TDs are not capable of doing it.
No, but this is very technical work and it's highly, highly technical work. And, you know, even RTE doing an investigative programme, you get the assistance of experts to do your investigation as well as the reporters doing it. But I think it's important that the inquiry commands respect and that it does command respect, particularly among the people of Ireland, and obviously that the politicians respect the work they're doing.
Okay, so on that point, Joan, I've got to ask you this. The Taoiseach, therefore, is being unwise in making those political points and blaming it all on Fianna Fáil before we've got those answers.
I mean, the Taoiseach was answering on the order of business, and what he said was that there was a nexus and there were connections between the banks, the developers and Fianna Fáil.
No, there was a nexus, a nexus of collusion, Minister.
Billy's just coming back in, Minister, I'm not sure. Billy, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, look, I mean, he said there was a nexus of collusion and he tried to highlight and, you know, throw this political charge into something. I mean, if people want to have the respect and the confidence of any inquiry, and I'm saying quite clearly, yes, have an inquiry, but I mean, obviously people don't want to even read the reports that were presently published, which shows quite clearly, you know, the lead up to the events, the actual event itself on the night of the guarantee and the fallout from that. Now, I mean, if people don't want to accept Nyberg or Patrick Honan, fine, let the minister and others look for another inquiry. But in the meantime, if people are to have confidence, all the people that are at the heart of this should be involved in any inquiry that will bring to the truth. And I mean, the minister makes the point about, you know, expert advice and all the rest of it. Yes, the government of the day had the advice available to it. It was the regulator, it was the central bank, they had Merrill, they had Price Waterhouse Cooper's reports, they have, you know, and they had Bank of Ireland and AIB in on the night explaining how difficult it was and what would happen if there wasn't some form of guarantee put in place. And Patrick Honan summed it up in his own report, Minister, and if you don't want to accept Patrick Honan's report, you know, throw it out and have another report. But they said quite clearly, if a major guarantee of some form was not brought in, it would have had a catastrophic effect, not only on banking,
actually,
but on the country.
Governor Honan's report drew a specific reference to the broad breadth of the guarantee and whether that was actually required. And remember that
Minister,
the reason that many people criticised...
What he's arguing is over subordinated debt. He agreed with the broad principle of the guarantee, but he was saying that it was too broad and subordinated debt.
You're spinning as hard as possible, understandably, on behalf of your own party. But just let me go back to what I think people in Ireland want. They want to hear the story. The Nyberg report and the other three reports which were commissioned by Fianna Fáil, they don't name names and they don't tell the story in ways that are understandable.
And the parliamentary inquiry that is allegedly coming under Brendan Howland's legislation wouldn't name names either, because it wouldn't make findings against individuals before it
so that individuals would come and tell the story of what happened.
But just no, let me say, Claire,
this is something, that was a matter for the advice of the courts. There was an attempt, as you know, there was a referendum put to the people, which people in their wisdom decided not to support.
Will there be another one?
I think the jury is out on that.
What do you think?
I think we should proceed with the legislation which Brendan Howland is developing at the moment, because there's a lot of legal advice to say that properly constructed, with due respect to the rules of inquiry that are fair, it is possible, as I said, with fairly expert advice to that committee.
So you're not in favour of rerunning that referendum?
Well, I think at this point in time we would need to sit down and think very carefully, because remember, every other parliament in the world is able to carry out inquiries where, by the way, there can be a lot of politics. I mean, parliament is a political place, but the point is it has to be conducted with respect and with serious advice about who you question, the questions you ask, and then that it is conducted in a fair manner.
Okay.
And I think having legal and...
You undermined the chair of the PAC for the last 2 months, Minister. I'm just making a point, political point, but I mean, it is a reality. The chairman of the PAC was being undermined consistently by the government for the previous 2 months.
Okay, Billy, I want to bring Brian Lucy in here, because we haven't heard another voice since we got started.
Indeed.
Brian.
And I think that's exactly, all over the country, people are turning off the radios before they hurl them at the wall.
I hope not, but anyway.
They're hurling them at the wall because the one thing the people, I don't think, want is they don't want to see this politicised. It has been. And once it's politicised by one side or the other, then the political system will gleefully leap upon it like a pack of crows on a crust of bread. People want to find out who did what when. They actually want vengeance, but let's rise above our baser natures. As I understand, and it could be completely wrong, the constitutional prohibition is on adverse findings of fact. Fine. Let's just get findings of fact. I don't think it's constitutionally... I would be amazed if it was constitutionally improper for somebody to be asked, so Claire, what did you do? I did X. Okay,
yeah, but you can ask, but you can't find against that.
Oh, no, but it's not finding conclusion. Against. You can simply report, you know, Claire said that she did X.
Because Brian...
Claire, is that...
Just to put this to you, Brendan Howland was on the 6-1 during the week, and he said that it would be enough, he believed, for the public to hear people giving evidence.
Absolutely.
And make their own mind up about that evidence.
But people have made their minds up, I think. I think people have made their minds up.
Is
over
that
the last...
enough?
No, it's not. It's justice delayed and that's justice denied. We haven't... By putting together all of the bits and pieces that are out there, we've a pretty good idea of what happened, when, where and why. We don't have all the nuance. We never will, because it's 5 years on. It'll be 6 or 7 or 8 years on by the time anybody ever ends up in front of either a court or a Dáil committee or an inquiry. So at that stage, memories, you know, are fallible. So at this stage, I think we really perhaps need to think about drawing a line underneath this. I mean, the best succinct examination of it that I've seen recently has been Colin Murphy's play, because it gives a really good example of the kinds of pressures that people are under, making pressures with limited information and, as we now see, incomplete and possibly even false information under huge pressure. We know about the guarantee. We know the government had a suite of options. We know the government took one of the options that was contra-recommended, to put it mildly. They did that for, I'm sure, what they thought at the time were good reasons. We know the consequences of that. What has come out this week is, to me, evidence that The financial system as a whole didn't learn, and I don't think has learned. And I think if you look over the last 4 or 5 years, what you've seen is a financial system which has absolutely captured, I won't say the moral high ground because I don't think that comes into it, but has captured the rhetoric and has captured the policy and the process. Because at all stages, the financial system in this country and elsewhere has driven forward pretty much on the lines that it would want to do. It is a remarkable situation.
Even now,
that,
so nothing
even
has
now,
changed.
Even now. Yes, we've had some of the top people in the financial system leave. And we've seen some people taking redundancy. But the processes and the structures and the attitudes and the policies that they are pursuing are pretty much the same as they were before. And that, I think, is going to lead us into grave difficulty because, as I point out today in the Irish Examiner, the government policy is, for, again, what seemed like good reasons at the time, and this government has inherited and carried it on, to have effectively a banking duopoly, to have two pillar banks and a bunch of smaller banks. And that is going to lead, that is designing banks that are too big to fail. And as a consequence, 5, 10, 15 years down the line,
back there again,
these banks will say, we are too big to fail. We were designed to be too big to fail. They will capture the regulators and they will go on and do the same old shenanigans.
OK. Ian Keogh, I want to bring you in on particularly on what we've heard today and your judgment on its significance.
Yeah, I suppose Billy Kelleher was making the point, should we take David Drum's word for it? I think the one thing, I'd actually give an awful lot of credence to what he was saying at the time, because he's not looking back with hindsight. He's not trying to justify it in the cold light of day 5 years on. It's kind of a temporal view of exactly what's going on and how it's going down. And I think it's astounding. It raises, both today and all week, raises far more questions than we have answers. For a start, when did the government get the notion that if Merrill Lynch came along and said, you know, put a bullet in Anglo-Irish Bank, how did the government decide that it was of systemic importance and needed to be saved at all costs?
But Billy Kelleher says that the damage was already done at that stage.
Presumably, Merrill Lynch were in place for a number of months. Mm-hmm. At this point, Alan Jukes had come onto the board of,
and
they were talking about pumping €10 billion into the various banks. So, I mean, Merrill Lynch had been advising the government for a number of months, even prior to the guarantee. So it was only at that point David Drum learned that that was the plan. But we don't know how long the plan was there. Again, another unanswered question. I think the big thing that we've learned this week of what was going on then in 2008 is, you know, the arrogance of the bankers, mm-hmm. the petulance and the fact that they felt they could simply walk down to the financial regulator and the central bank demanding money, as David Drum puts it, with his arms swinging.
And they did, and they got
it. But even more, they got more. They got a whole guarantee as opposed to the €7 billion that they wanted. But the other big thing is the profound weakness of the financial regulator and the central bank, that they didn't see anything wrong with this, that it was perfectly acceptable for bankers to wander down there, demand money and put up very little resistance
because
to it.
In a way, you'd almost expect bankers at that time to behave in the way that they behaved. But as you say, that it was accepted by those who were looking after our interests is perhaps the bigger question.
Absolutely. I mean, David Drum was doing what I presume any banker in his position would do. He was trying to keep his bank afloat by getting money in through hell or high water. The bigger question has to be asked, why was it up to David Drum to go down and give the regulator a briefing on the state of his balance sheet, on the state of the liquidity? They are fundamental questions for the operation of the bank, and the regulator should have been all over those things, and yet they weren't. And I think this, just to tie it into the broader conversation that people have been having about the banking inquiry, I hope we get it and I hope it's right, but I think it has to go beyond merely throwing accusations and questions at the bankers and at the politicians. That's fine, and it'll be a great public spectacle to get the real answers. Everybody has to be accountable. So I'm talking about the people in the financial regulator, the people in the central bank, the advisors, and also the people in the Department of Finance, a large number of whom still occupy the same mm-hmm. positions or have been promoted in the aftermath since. And it begs a question. Look, we're having this discussion now with the fifth anniversary of the bank guarantee just months away. Why have we waited so long? Why does it take tapes from the Irish Independent published by them to kind of reinvigorate the debate to get it pushed on? Is there really a willingness, both within the minister's government and also within the officials, to have a real bank inquiry? I was astounded this week when the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, said the first he knew of the existence of the tapes was when they were published by the Irish Independent. If they were really trying to uncover, and if his department was really trying to uncover what had gone on within the banks, they would have known about the existence of those tapes and they would have read them line by line.
Mm-hmm. Minister, do you want to respond to that, that we have seen a lack of urgency when it comes to establishing this banking inquiry? Well, and it's only now that, we're looking at doing it with expediency.
If you look at the sequence of events of what has happened and what is happening and will happen at the moment, the most important thing is that there are a number of people due to come before the courts, as I understand it, early in the new year in relation to charges, in relation to people who are officers of this bank. Now, I think, obviously, we have to be completely circumspect in relation to that. But I think it is of critical importance that those proceedings should proceed, because at the end of the day, what will really change Irish public life or Irish business life is where there are regulations, and the regulations, are not upheld or are breached. And obviously, it's for the courts independently to decide that. Well, then there have to be serious sanctions.
And so we're going to hold off. Are you saying we should hold off?
No. I'm saying that we have to be circumspect because there is a vast amount of information which has been with the Gardaí and with the DPP now for, I think, going on for more than 3 years. I do hope that those cases come before the courts, and I understand that may be hopefully early in the new year. I think that that is really, really important. But I also think what Ian is saying about looking at the regulator and the central bank is terribly important. I have never understood, and I'll say this, I said it publicly on many occasions, why action was not taken in relation to Irish banking and its oversight and supervision when Northern Rock had people queuing in the streets, because that was an absolute signal, a full year before our guarantee, that something was gone wrong with a banking model where bankers had become masters of the world. You had a globalised banking model. Now, one of the things, by the way, Ireland has done during the European presidency is we have been chairing meetings which have in effect begun to put a shape on the prevention of this kind of meltdown again. Bear in mind as well another thing that's being said, that nobody knew that this had ever happened before. There was a banking crash in Sweden. There was a banking crash in Finland. There were actually, and this is again what I'd like an answer to, and I was a spokesperson for the Labour Party on finance at the time. I went to the trouble at the time of having a look at what had happened in Sweden. So I think that some of the people around the table here, because it was well known that they basically had a resolution process. We lacked a resolution process. That's a way of shutting down errant banks. That's the technical term for it. We only developed that actually almost as we were beginning to sort of stabilise several years after the crisis. So it's, there are just so many questions that do require to be answered.
David Hall.
Just a few very brief points, Claire. As I say, as the Taoiseach mentioned, I and many others will be many of the tens of thousands of people throughout the country and more than tens of thousands of people who have been directly affected by what went on. In a society I live in, normally if there's a grave crime been witnessed by somebody, I would have an expectation that person would come forward and give the relevant evidence of what was witnessed. On the night in question, there are multiple people who are present that night who are still being paid by us, who have not come forward of their own volition or have not been given a capacity to come forward to give the story. This is now a €64 billion story as to what happened around the circumstance around it. I, like many others, wouldn't be as admirably qualified as Brian and others in relation to the financial nuances of what went on. We do, however, know the result, and the result has been a hugely damaging effect on society, on communities and on mental health throughout the state. Mm-hmm. So answers are required, whatever means is required to do that. I think, you know, most people really, really have, irrespective of the political views, have now got a very clear unease in relation to children throwing stones at each other. We deserve, after 64 billion of a generation being eliminated from financial distress and pressure, we deserve those answers. And all of those individuals on the night, all of them, and I love seeing late night legislation, as you know, rushed through the Dáil to benefit banks. I've yet to see some happen to benefit the curiosity, the interest and the requirements of the public. So it's a long time now that the right, as Ian says, the correct format is now established, and we deserve, we've 64 billion euro of skin in the game ourselves, we deserve those answers.
All one right. tiny question, I think, Claire, Brian, needs to be asked, and David has touched upon it. And, you know, despite the popular impression, people in the Dáil do work, and the Seanad do work extremely hard. But, you know, in the last 30 years, we've seen two emergency sittings, both to benefit private institutions, the beef and the banking situation. To me, it is a source of extraordinary frustration, and I suspect it is to many others, that we don't see the Dáil sitting with urgency, day and night. If this legislation, Minister, is nearly ready, which I'm sure it is, then why not bring it to the Dáil? And then, if necessary, walk it down to the Supreme Court, and I'm sure they'd expedite a review, and if it's not constitutionally bulletproofed, go back and do it again. We have the Dáil consumed with issues that have been there for a long
time. If the government did that, would they not be accused of ramming it through
I don't think so. They might be accused. They'll be accused by the opposition of doing all sorts of things, and they would accuse the government, you know, if they were there. So let's forget the politics of it. Let's see the government actually do what it's supposed to do in terms of this and govern. There's no reason why this can't be put through before the end of the session, which is, I think, the 21st or so of July. It is vitally important that we get clarity on the X case, and it's vitally important that we deal with the Seanad. But these have been there for a long time. And the issue of the banking inquiry is both urgent and important. Right. And I don't see why the Dáil can't pull the stops out and really, if it really, really sees this as important, go to the wall and do it.
That's the expectation of the Minister, Brendan Howland, that he will actually be able to have the legislation completed by the time the Dáil rises.
But will it be John?
What?
Will it be through? Will it be passed into law?
I would certainly hope so, but can I just say, I'm not a lawyer. And every day that you're in politics, you realise that legislation that is going to work and be effective, it does really have to be legally tested. And
which
that does,
that
does, that does, yeah, and I think that's quite an interesting proposal. That's really a matter as well, obviously, for the President of Ireland and the Council of State, but it is certainly an interesting thought. It's important, as I said, that the legislation should be passed as early as possible. And I do think, notwithstanding the political temperature that was very raised this week, that if we put our minds to structuring a proper inquiry, and all of the people who were party to this, the regulators, the central bank, the politicians, and obviously primarily the bankers, that we can, with the cooperation. But remember, in the history of other tribunals, Brian, people have taken a very quick, fast walk to the forecourts, put their hands up and said, this is what this legislation is seeking to have people to tell the story, but without, as Claire was saying at the beginning, as it were, findings of fact as such against
an individual. Okay, we're going to leave that one there. We're moving on to not an unrelated subject, because we're going to be talking about mortgage arrears and the new code of conduct, which was published by the central bank this week. That's in just a moment. This is Saturday with Clara Byrne. Joan Burton is still with us, as is Ian Keogh, David Hall, Brian Lucy and Billy Kelleher. And we move on now to the Code of Conduct, which was introduced by the Central Bank this week. And it has been described as a banker's charter. David Hall, come to you first on this. This is your area of expertise. Basically, what you're saying is that the banks have been told, do whatever you like, just get the money back.
But similarly to what happened this week with the Anglo-Tapes, the banks have asked for more powers and were given them. The central bank rolled over in an instant. So if you take last Friday week, where the central bank's own arrears figure showed further escalation in arrears, both on the three main categories of 90 days, those above 360 days, 1 year of 4% increase, and then a 12% increase, remarkably 12% increase of those above a 2 year arrears. The 1 and 2 year accumulation of arrears totals 53,000. The total exposure of that loan book is 10.8 billion euros. So they're the statistics and the backdrop by which this code of conduct was published. In normal worlds, in normal jurisdictions, when banks have failed to act for 5 years, you don't reward them. They come to you saying, we need trackers dealt with, we need people who aren't cooperating dealt with, and they were given additional powers. Some will say it'll make no difference, but this leads to suspicion as to why give people torturous, exceptional circumstances to allow them torture borrowers.
But are we in this weird sort of situation, this limbo land, where we have close to, as you say, 54,000 people who are in arrears for a year or more?
2 years, yeah.
Like, a lot of those people, surely, just can't afford to stay in those homes.
No, people will lose their homes. There's no question people will lose their homes. But the inaction and the lack of structure and organisation means potentially more will lose their homes unnecessarily. So people will lose their homes, and everyone knows people will lose their homes in these circumstances. This is not about an expectation to try and leave everybody. You can't leave someone in a 7-bedroomed house worth 2 million where there's two people rattling around it and both are unemployed. That's not a realistic situation. But it is not fair to say that 144 split mortgages with the governor of the central bank and all other parties and commentators, I included, keep referring to this magical, mystical solution of a split mortgage, where the central bank itself has not determined what is a sustainable mortgage to determine how many people will lose their homes. Then we have a situation where, you know, banks owned by the state are then going to repossess properties of families who are living in certain areas of the country, who are then going to be given money by the local authority to then go and pay a foreign bank to rent a home. So there's joined up thinking. And in these figures of mortgage arrears, we don't have the local authority arrears figures. They're exempt from this. So this is an unholy mess. And what's happened over the last 5 years has been a complete inaction to protect the balance sheets.
So what do you want to see happen?
I want to see a very clear solution. First of all, I'd like to see Fiona Muldoon having what's called a last resort. Everyone keeps mentioning last resort. Christine Lagarde, the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach. Everyone keeps saying repossessions will take as a last resort. We presented to Fiona Muldoon. What should happen as a last resort is a bank should evidence to the central bank that all options have been explored prior to their family home being repossessed. At this current moment in time, the central bank does not require any banking institution within the state to have any number of products available, such as mortgage to rent. And the Minister of Finance disingenuously keeps referring to a suite of options. There are not a suite of options. The Code of Conduct under Section 39 lists options, but it does not compel the banks to provide those options. And all sanctions against the borrower, only a bank that provides a number of basic fundamental options to protect people should be allowed to use those options.
Okay. And Billy Kelleher, to come to you on this, there is David's view, and then there is the other view that this will push this along finally, once and for all. It will force the banks to do something about all of these mortgages. Many of these mortgages are just unsustainable.
Well, 5 years talking about it now, and certainly the banks, at the very least, could be accused of complete inaction and basically putting their heads in the sand. I mean, nobody wants, the banks to move aggressively and start evicting people from their homes. But what this code of conduct actually does is encourages banks to do that. And, you know, I raised this particular issue in the Dáil this week with the minister. Like, the code is quite clear. It basically allows the banks to provide sustainable solutions, but it is the banks themselves that will decide what is a sustainable solution. Now, to a family that's in huge distress, massive negative equity, no option of making repayments in the short term, you know, that's a fairly unsustainable solution. But it's the bank that comes up with the solution to this problem. And I'm just worried that the banks will start cherry picking. And I think this is a very key point. The banks are distressed. Their mortgage books are under huge, loan books under huge pressure. And they will start cherry picking the houses that have some equity in them but are in an unsustainable position at the present time. And that is the key issue that the government have failed to address, that the banks will become aggressive in repossession.
Okay, so they'll only repossess the houses that are worth repossessing.
Well, if I was a bank and if I'm trying to address my impaired balance sheet, my loan book, to try and get out from underneath the claws of the government in terms of ownership and all that flows from that, of course the obvious thing is they will start going after houses that have equity in them but are presently in an unsustainable position. And I can guarantee you over the next 6 to 8 months you will see a situation where it's houses in the affluent locations, it's in houses in the areas where there's actually potential to sell these houses, they'll be the ones that will be repossessed and the others will be ignored for some longer period of time. And I think that simply is just unacceptable, that there's no independent oversight of what is a sustainable solution.
Ian, that's an interesting point.
It is. To be honest, I think given the scale of the mortgage arrears crisis and the level of people, I think it's a little bit much to suggest that the banks are going to walk down one side of a street and pick out the individual mortgages. I think on the bigger point is the reason this has gone on for 5 years is because the banks simply don't want to fix it. Mm-hmm. As soon as they fix it, and this is the issue for the government because and the taxpayer in particular, as soon as they fix it, a hole of an unknown proportion is going to emerge in the balance sheets of the banks that can fundamentally only be fixed by the state ploughing more money into the banks. I think it's the reason we're not seeing stress tests on
David,
the banks this year.
You said 10 billion, over to 10.6.
The value of the loans for 1 and 2 years, there's only 1 and 2 years of those that are in arrears for 1 and 2 years is 10.8 billion. The amount of outstanding arrears, just the arrears figure, now not the value of the entire mortgages, is 1.9 billion. They're the current figures that the central bank's report shows. So the inaction, and Ian, as I would slightly disagree, and if you look at the High Court list and try and dig into where the addresses are in relation to those properties that have been repossessed, there is a very interesting geographical spread in relation to where they are being just, you know, where they're being repossessed. But fundamentally, the central bank to cure this doesn't seem to either want to cure it, because if they did, you basically stop giving expectations to banks. We've all had the expectations mm-hmm. from the banks shattered. You bring them into the room, you sit them down and say, guys, this is how we're going to do these things. This is how work is going to continue from here on in. You will have a mortgage to rent product, which you don't have to have at the moment. You will have a split loan product under that. You will have debt for equity swap, and you will, if you repossess, yeah. will write off the debt.
Okay, but Ian, what you're saying is that nobody wants to face up to this problem, and actually this code doesn't force the banks to face up to this problem because there's no sanction
There's no sanction. I know the central bank and Fiona Muldoon have given targets, but it's very easy to reclassify a loan yeah. and move them into a different product. And once they're in that product, you move them onto another product, and you can have a merry-go-round all day long. There are so many different solutions, both for mortgages and personal yeah. debts, that even debt advisors are confused at the level of yeah. them at the moment. That you can simply go from A to B to C to D. All of them are well intentioned and well meaning, but when you have so many options, you just end up absolutely getting nowhere. But I think the crucial point is, if there is a willingness from the banks and pushed on by the central bank to really deal with this problem, they can deal with it as quickly as they want.
Joan, I know you have to go, so I want to get your take on this.
Well, I think this is going to be a very big test of the kind of central bank we have now with absolutely. Its independence. And I think it is going to really put it up to the central bank to deal sensitively, and I use that word given the distress that David has spoken about, that so many people are in at so many different levels. But just let me say, the key other piece of legislation that the government now has in place is the Insolvency Service of Ireland. And the option is there for some people. And in my view, I think it will be an option that will be advised by some of the advisors, like David, to people who are hopelessly distressed, that they look at that option. They will have a personal insolvency practitioner to
Where
work
are we
out.
With that? Where are we oh, with the personal
The Insolvency Service of Ireland has actually, I think, started formally this
lovely,
week.
Lovely offices.
Well, I think they're former government offices that
Ryanair owned them. They're lovely offices, lovely cushy carpets. Very little else is happening in there at the moment. Yesterday, some exam results came out for professional insolvency practitioners in relation to who passed their exams. But the problem is that Minister Burton, has a number of excellent people within her department, and also an excellent organisation under her wing, which is MABS, which has been wholly neglected by this government and the previous government in relation to providing services to debtors. And at this late stage, I still urge the Minister to consider a public insolvency practitioner for those people who can't afford. This is a privatised system, the PIPS.
Well, just let me say that the government and my department and the Citizens Information Board and MABS spend a total of 47 million. And let me say that David is well aware that right around the country, people involved in the MABS services do excellent work. We're also training people,
absolutely.
As well, as David is aware, in the context of the new insolvency service. But the critical thing is you have to bring the lender and the borrower together. And with the borrower now having an option for some borrowers in relation to using the insolvency, people are familiar with people like some of the big business people heading to England and achieving a bankruptcy and clearance of debts through courts. We are going to have that option exercised, and I'm sure people like David will be advising it to some of the people that they work with for the first time.
It has taken
a lot of time to get this legislation through, because we just had the Victorian insolvency legislation that we inherited from the British. And once this is available, there will actually be a better resource available to very distressed borrowers if their position is absolutely beyond sustainable. Okay. But otherwise, the bankers, the lenders and the borrowers can come together. And the central bank is going to have to show its mettle by supervising this in a fair and sustainable way. It is a very big test for what the central bank has learned from the episodes that we've just spoken about
okay,
earlier.
And I want to get Brian's take on that in just a moment. But I'm watching the clock for you because I know you have to go. But before you do, you said earlier on when we were talking about the banking inquiry that you'd like to see it, just to be clear, chaired by an expert in the legal
law? No, I didn't say who should chair it at all. Let me be clear about that. What I said is should be resourced for example, an experienced lawyer with experience of civil proceedings, banks and which a lot of them now have, and resourced and also by somebody like a forensic accountant who has an understanding of banking and of forensic accounting. Because we're talking about serious wrongdoing in what happened. So it's not just an ordinary accountant. You need somebody with serious forensic experience.
So it will be chaired by an Oireachtas committee chairperson.
Well, I mean, I don't want to prejudge what the Oireachtas will decide in detail on the legislation. But the members, as in other jurisdictions, will come from the parliamentary tier of the Dáil and the Seanad. But they would be given expert advice. We have that to a small degree with the Public Accounts Committee, where the Controller and Auditor General is often the advisor to the Public Accounts Committee where there are matters to be inquired into. But if we're to do this properly, we do have to resource it with people who have the expertise to, as I say, identify who should be questioned, the timelines, the matters to be inquired in, and above all then, the people from the four, as it were, quarters that people spoke about politics, the government of the time and the serving officials of the time, the civil servants, regulator and the central bank okay. and primarily the banks themselves.
All right, Joan, thank you very much. And I know you have to go to another appointment. Ian Keogh, you wanted to come in on that?
It's very interesting because if you see the Dirt Inquiry, which took place a decade ago by the Public Accounts Committee, chaired at the time by the late Gay Mitchell, is often held a lot as a shining beacon of parliamentary mm-hmm. oversight. It did a great job, fine, but it based all its work and all of its questions and all of its probing upon a report by the Controller and Auditor General. Without that sort of research, it wouldn't have gone anywhere. We've seen a banking inquiry in Britain into the LIBOR scandal, four very informative and heavy-hitting reports, again, with serious backup for it. It mightn't have been liked by the Irish government, but the US Senate Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations, their work on the Apple tax shenanigans, again, backed up by significant resources and by investigative powers. If the banking inquiry is to work, it needs both of those things. It needs proper resources and proper powers. In the current climate, it has neither.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I go back to the Code of Conduct very briefly?
Yes, David.
And very importantly to say to those who are listening today who are distressed and are under pressure, you know, banks, I don't trust. Many people don't trust them. Their evidence before everybody and the central bank itself shows clearly their inaction and their sort of distrust and for everybody. So for those who are in difficulty, they need to take some advice now over the next number of weeks. They can't leave their head in the sand. They must take their head out of the sand. They can contact ourselves at www.mortgageholders.ie. There's MABS, there's other non-for-profit organisations, and there's paid professionals whom they can pay, seek what their costs are and know what their costs are in advance. I know it sounds crazy paying for your own funeral, but that's part of the business we're in now. So it is very important to seek advice. This code of conduct has a number of things in it that are very dangerous for the borrower. It allows banks to torture people, and that's clearly what it does, because in the absence of any evidence of any action for the last 5 years, it serves no purpose other than to intimidate and harass people to give these powers to the banks.
Because there's unlimited contact now.
Unlimited contact can send someone to your
house.
From
the bank to the borrower.
And the central bank should have done a very simple thing to protect borrowers. They should have recorded all telephone calls and mandated banks to record telephone calls, leave the telephone calls on their server. Everyone rings a financial institution and gets a dingle which someone says, this might be recorded for training purposes, stuff training purposes. Consumer protection is what it needs to be recorded for. Held in the central bank and they can dip in and out of phone calls. That would put a little bit of manners on the banks straight away. And
if only we had tapes to know what the banks
were. If only we had tapes.
Yeah. Could I broaden this out a little bit? Because one of the issues is that between mortgages and personal debt, there's about 100 billion euro outstanding by the banks. Now, we don't know how much of that is ultimately going to have to be written off. Let's say 5%, for example. That's 5 billion that has to be taken off the capital base of, I'm talking here primarily about the covered banks, the AIB, Bank of Ireland, etc. At the same time, the banks are also having to shrink because they're still going through this deleveraging process that we've been talking about because of the fact that they ran into the sand. And they're also being asked by the government to expand lending in certain areas, such as SMEs, etc., which they're finding difficult to do. There's a number of circles here which are being trying to be squared. And David mentioned the lack of joined-up thinking, which is something that bedevils every aspect of Irish policy making. The bottom line is that all of these are going to make it in the next decade or more a much more difficult and much more credit-constrained environment for people individually and commercially to work within. We're going to be facing an ongoing credit crunch, in other words. And we have got used as a country and as a society and as an economy to easy, if not necessarily cheap, credit. That's changing, and that's changing worldwide. And that is the fundamental change in how many people have thought about how doing their lives. That's an educational issue. That's where we need much more information about how do we, as SMEs, finance ourselves when the bank isn't available? How do we, as consumers, decide that, no, in fact, we're not going to go for an upgrade to our Sky TV or we're not going to go on another holiday? It's learning old-fashioned habits of prudence and old-fashioned ways of doing business, which will mean, in consequence, a slower economy than that which we have been used to, which then leads to a slower recovery.
Dare I say, becoming more Germanic in our outlook?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, the Dutch are very Germanic, and yet they have incredibly high levels of personal debt. The Germans, you know, have significant problems themselves. But it means going back to an old-fashioned way of doing business,
but that's
and slower. But that is an important issue, David, because the slower issue means that the recovery in the economy is going to be that much slower than perhaps many people think.
David,
that's why a lot of people are not prioritising their debts, and they're protecting themselves against exactly what Brian is saying. They're looking after their credit card, they're looking after their credit union, and that's wrong. They need to prioritise their home, and I sound like a banker now, which is actually very scary. They need to prioritise their home, but they need to seek advice in doing so. Yeah. And because of their concerns around credit and access to credit, they're being very careful whom else to look after. Because the bank's in action, if I was to lose my house, I might have my credit card and my credit union paid off. That's the theory. Okay. So it's a failure of the banks that caused that also.
Okay, seek advice is the advice. We're back in a moment. We're going now to RTE's Midlands correspondent, Ciarán Mullooly. Ciarán, we're talking to you because there has been a standoff today in a couple of locations between turf cutters and the Gardaí. Can you bring us up to date with what's been happening?
Yes, indeed, Claire. Tapes from banking conversations can come and go, but the long-running issue of cutting on protected bog sites around the country continues. It's been a really busy morning because there have been about 200 turf cutters involved in these incidents on two different sites, one in Monavea in County Galway, one in Kiltevin in County Roscommon. And it started really early. At 4 a.m., we're told, turf cutting began on protected sites which are protected for scientific and nature reasons around in those two locations. The National Parks and Wildlife Service reacted, as is their duty, and came to the area, and that they then followed visits by the Gardaí. Now, one of the incidents has just come to an end in the last few moments. That's at Kiltevin in County Roscommon. I was there a little while ago. Pete Gillooly, who's a local turf cutter, a member of the Turf Cutters and Contractors Association, told me it arose simply because these are farmers who were not given alternative sites to cut their turf. And he says it's still a big issue for them. There were there about 35 farmers there when the Gardaí arrived, including a superintendent who was refused access to the bog. He wanted to get some pictures, talk to the contractors. That didn't happen. The Gardaí did stay at the scene for a while, and they have been continuing their investigation. And I gather in the last few moments they have left. But in Monavea and County Galway, the situation continues there. This is a bigger site, a couple of hundred farmers involved in terms of cutting turf there normally. Today, I gather there's 80 or 100 people there at the moment, over 15 Gardaí. The same thing, there are machines on that site at the moment who have been involved in cutting of turf, and the Gardaí are anxious to find out the names of the owners, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Now, this, when this legislation came down to us from on high in Europe, there was a commitment given, wasn't there, that an alternative site would be provided. So what you're hearing from the farmers there, or from the turf cutters rather, is that those sites weren't provided.
This is certainly at the crux of what's happening today, particularly the one in Roscommon, Clare, because Pete Gillooly from the Turfcutters and Contractors Association was adamant that there are 24 locals involved in that protest this morning. People who have been cutting, as indeed their families have been for decades, at fir bog, it's known locally in County Roscommon. And he says the simple fact is they have not been offered alternative locations. And they don't want the money. They don't want the cash alternatives. They're looking for alternative locations to cut their turf on a regular basis. And this is going to continue now for a number of days, because it's getting late in the season and there's a certain amount of, shall we say, urgency on this now, because unless these turf, the banks are cut in the next couple of, these banks of turf are cut in the next few weeks, they'll be lost for this year.
Indeed, I was going to say to you, it's a little late to be cutting turf in the first instance, but are you saying that turf has been cut today in these locations?
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt. I mean, I was there this morning when the superintendent and eight Gardaí were in a position to simply look out over a drainway at the side of the road and see it being cut before their very eyes. And that's been going on as well in Munavee. So it's, I put it to Pete Gillooly from the association that it was blatant breaking of the law by some of the people who were there this morning. He said they have no choice. He said they reject the fact that so many acres were included as special areas of conservation in the first instance. They say it was incorrect to put in so many acres. They shouldn't be there. And he said they have no choice because they have no other alternative locations.
Kieran, thank you very much for that. Billy Kelleher is still in Cork. Billy, are you a turf cutter?
Well, I live in East Cork, so turf cutting wouldn't be my strongest point, Claire. But I mean, look, there's two things here. First and foremost, they were to be offered alternative sites. That clearly hasn't happened. But in the meantime, there's also laws there, and we want people to comply with the law. But I mean, the department and the National Parks and Wildlife have an obligation to enforce laws, but equally they have an obligation to ensure that those that were offered alternative sites actually get alternative sites.
Well, it looks as though the damage has been done. If you're in favour of conserving the bogs today, in that the turf has been cut, right?
I wonder how many of the people cutting the turf would this evening be sitting in the pub or over their dinner saying, God, those bankers breaking the law is terrible.
Oh, there you
this
go.
Is the problem we have in this country, is that we run with the hare and we hunt with the hounds when it comes to the law. It is, you know, we've been talking earlier on about the DPP, etc. And yet we have a Garda superintendent being refused access, leaning over a ditch, watching the law being broken. And we expect that the DPP and the guards will get to grips.
Two sides to every story, Brian. Two sides to every story. If they weren't given the alternative sides,
no, but that's not the point, Claire. It's like saying the bankers weren't given alternatives. Now, I mean, the reality is, can we really expect this state to conduct itself in a modern fashion when you have a Garda superintendent leaning over a ditch watching the law being broken?
We're way over time. I've got to stop you there. Thank you to all my guests today. We're back next week at 1 o'clock.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher is Leslie Anderson. The broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland. And audio supervision this week was by Dave Gibson.